We have a translation special today, and where better to start than with
anti-disestablishmentarianism.
Thank you, Google Translate. Anti-disestablishmentarianism, said to be the longest word in the English language, once. No longer is, but it's a great word to play with. Now, as you can imagine, Google Translate doesn't want to translate this word into many other languages, but, and I love this, it will offer up foreign pronunciations of the word. And even with a phonetically complex word like this, they sound pretty good.
Anti-disestablishmentarianism.
That's Hungarian, now Spanish.
Anti-disestablishmentarianism.
And Danish.
Anti-disestablishmentarianism.
And now, Japanese.
Anti-disestablishmentarianism.
That's crazy! I don't know what happened there.
Δεκάνει κρύο στην Ελλάδα. Κρύο δεν έκανε ποτέ. Έλα απόψε για να νιώσεις όπως δεν ένιωσες ποτέ.
So today, a check-in with Translation Nation and its foot soldiers, the American Translators Association. How are they doing post 9/11, post Wall Street crash, post Google Translate? Also, a conversation with David Bellos, who's written a history of translation, and a very loose, I won't say translation, a very loose rendering of the Iliad, together with a shock for traditionalists, a new take on the friendship of Achilles and his best buddy.
I think many of the ancients would have said that Achilles and Patroclus were lovers. And you know, there's no such thing as a definitive Greek myth.
And there's also no such thing as the definitive Greek joke. Though the band that plays this song has quite a few good jokes. In Greece today, in the face of economic Armageddon, the standard mode of expression is dark, dark humor. So, here we go. And aside from Greek comedy at the rump of today's pod, it's translation all the way through. We'll hear about how professional translators are faring in these murky times, murky at least as far as economics and technology are concerned. We also have a take on translation from David Bellos, who's written a very well-received history of translation. He himself is a translator of novels that are often considered impossible to translate. His method, he says, is to ignore the words themselves. Words can be a bit of a red herring. Then, with so many different versions of the Iliad during the rounds, a conversation with Madeline Miller, who, depending on your point of view, has written a novel that draws much of its rich plot from the Iliad, or has taken massive and racy liberties with the beloved classic. First, Kevin Hensel with the American Translators Association. Now, the ATA just held their annual convention. I went along for a couple of days, talked to a bunch of people, some of whom you'll hear in future pods. Hensel is a longtime Russian translator. He even worked at the White House on the so-called hotline to Moscow. That'll definitely be in a future pod. Today, I want to play Hensel's comments on the state of the translation industry. And it is an industry, a multi-billion dollar one. I was interested to hear how translators fared during the recession and how they're doing now. As it turns out, says Hensel, just fine.
It's one of the very few industries anywhere in the world that actually increased during the recession. We had our 50th anniversary conference in New York City in 2009, and we actually had by far our largest turnout, which is an extraordinary thing when all other industries' conferences were actually falling off during that period. So we grew 15% that year, and we've grown 13% in each successive year through that period in terms of jobs, revenue, overall size of the industry.
And are there particular areas of the translation industry that are growing more rapidly than others? And are others, you know, falling off as a result of either the recession or, I don't know, machine translation?
Well, I'll take your last question first. Machine translation is driving a part of the market that has been largely neglected. Technically, there is an unlimited demand for translation into and from all languages. If we could snap our fingers and say, okay, magically, we could all communicate with each other all over the world instantly, with no error, then that would be what we'd want. If you look at that and you look at how many translators are available with the skill set, how much machine translation can do, and you put those on the table, they're really only satisfying 0.5% of what that demand is. And the machine translation is doing something different. It's doing large websites. It's doing millions of words at a time to try to get an idea of what the material is about. A machine translation is not designed to do finished copy. It's not designed to do important documents like legal documents or pharmaceutical inserts. Nothing where there's an error, absolutely zero error environment. And that's recognized by the manufacturers. Google themselves will tell you that Google Translate's great for websites, but Google itself does not use Google Translate on any of their own products. So they know that when it needs to be done right, you bring in a professional translator interpreter. In terms of what industries are driving the most or being driven the most important element to remember is that most U.S. companies make their profitability abroad. So if you look at GE, for example, and you actually look at their balance sheet, if it weren't for their sales abroad, they'd actually show a loss. And same thing with Pfizer. And same thing, you go down the list and you realize the enormous amount of just plain business that's going on in other countries by American manufacturers. So if you go out and buy a piece of hardware or equipment and you unfold the instructions in 40 languages, that's our business. That's what we do, is we make sure that we enable commerce to be global. And even through the recession, when money is behind it and when money is driving it, then there will be increased jobs for that. And that's a huge piece of it. Another one is in the United States. There's been, since 9/11, a significant year-over-year increase in federal spending. And that's on languages like Arabic and Pashto and Dari and Farsi and Urdu and Korean and Chinese and those languages. But that's a huge difference. It's gone up by a factor of about 10. You're talking about federal dollars. Most of that money actually goes through the Defense Department and through the intelligence community. There are 17 different intelligence agencies that make up that community, including one in the Defense Department. But a lot of that spending goes to support things that, like you think it would, troops in Iraq or Afghanistan, but there's an enormous investment in humanitarian efforts to support the military. In fact, there are far more interpreters that supported the Haitian relief effort than were in Iraq at the time. The U.S. Defense Department operates in 145 countries, virtually all of which are humanitarian efforts. They're rebuilding, they're assistance efforts, and all of those require translators and interpreters. So that's a very, very high requirement area is the Defense Department. There is a very large demand domestically in the United States for translation and interpreting for the immigrant community. So the immigrants that come to the United States may need legal services, or they need to go to a hospital, and they need to be able to speak to a physician. They need to speak to the police. All of those interactions require professional language support. And that market right there is enormous for hospitals and courtrooms. All the languages required, it's a $900 million a year market, just that one. The federal government market for non-classified, non-defense, the data that's available is $1 billion a year, just the available data. If you add in the other work that's done, it's about three times that. $3 billion. So there's a lot of drive in that. So between the commercial requirement, the federal international requirement, and then the internal domestic requirement for hospitals and law enforcement agencies and that kind of thing, that's where the demand is coming. And it's coming on all fronts, and it's coming continuously.
Kevin Hensel of the American Translators Association. A history of translation next, but first, a little commercial break. Just to say that if you like this podcast, well, you can do something about it. You can be an active user, as the online futurists say. First, you can comment on this podcast at theworld.org/language, where there's a blog post that goes with this episode. Or if you prefer, you can post your comment on Facebook. There's a World in Words page. Or you can contact me on Twitter. My handle is Patrick Cox, PatriCox. There's also another thing you can do. You can donate to PRI, Public Radio International. PRI, along with the BBC and WGBH, produces this pod and The Big Show. And ultimately, it's PRI and its donating listeners who ensure that this podcast is free to download. So if you want to help them out, go to PRI.org. Thank you. Now, David Bellos, a man who's thought long and hard about translation. He's turned it upside down, inside out, shaken all the loose change and candy wrappers out of its pockets, washed it, dried it, discovered it, shrunk, has restretched it. Where am I going with this? Someone help me out! Okay, David Bellos is at Princeton University, where he's in charge of the Translation and Intercultural Communication Program. He's also translated several novels, including one piece of fiction that was, still is, widely viewed as untranslatable. It is Life, a User's Manual by Georges Perec. Belos is also the author of Is That a Fish in Your Ear? Translation and the Meaning of Life. It's just been published. The following interview with Belos comes by way of the BBC. The man asking the questions is Ian McMillan. He's a poet when he's not on the radio. He's also a man with a ripe South Yorkshire accent. A few minutes into the conversation, you'll also hear from Janice Galloway. She's a novelist and memoirist who sets a lot of her books right where she was brought up in small town Western Scotland. So, the Belos book on translation contains the assertion that there's an illusion that language consists of things called words. Ian McMillan asked Belos why that's an illusion. Here's the answer.
Oh, it's an illusion induced by the education system that we've developed, partly since the Romans started trying to teach their young men Greek, most of all since the invention of the printed book, and above all since the generalization of this very strange thing called the General Purpose Dictionary. The idea that a language is a thing that consists of, you know, two parts, you know, a grammar, and on the other hand, a vocabulary, a set of words, is a product of our quite recent culture. And it isn't anything really to do with human speech and communication that goes back tens, maybe hundreds of thousands of years, much of which does not really consist of things called words. I mean, you think of sort of baby talk and pillow talk and doing and ahhing and exclaiming and so forth. There are lots of vocal noises that are very communicative, have to do with our relationships, but you can't really write them down because they're not words, or they're not words because we don't write them down.
So in the end, then, the translator's task is much more than the translation of words, and yet, on the page, that's all we have.
Absolutely. On the page, that's all you have. And it's often a great nuisance because the words really get in the way. Because what you need to translate is not the words, but the thing, the utterance, what's going on. And of course, the translator, whether it's an instruction manual for a new motor car or a beautiful poem written 100 years ago, what you're bringing across is not the words of which they happen to be made. What you're trying to bring across is what they are, you know, instruction manual or poem.
So somehow that's what it is. So in the end, the thing that you translate doesn't end up simply being a translation, but ends up being the thing itself?
Oh, well, no, it never... No. Translation cannot be the thing itself. No. The thing itself is the thing itself, and a translation is always something else. It bears a strong relationship to that which it represents, but it is not the thing itself. And I think the dream of some translators to produce the exact, complete, entire, and only exclusively that thing, save in another language, is, well, on the one hand, naive, and on the other hand, just doomed to fail. That's not what it's about, really.
So, David, what makes a good translator? Because you do talk about luck sometimes being involved.
A good translator is very, very, very old because he or she has read everything, knows everything, picks up all the allusions, including the obsolete ones and the obscure ones. But a good translator is also really quite young because he or she is right up to date with the state of the target language as it is spoken and indeed as it's going to be spoken and lived tomorrow. And somehow or other, I do think it's a matter of luck sometimes as to whether you just hit that thing that brings together a lot of knowledge and at the same time something appropriate that's going to work in the target language.
The oral translation, of course, is much older than the written kind. People would translate from other languages. That's still translation.
Of course. Speech is tens and probably hundreds of thousands of years old, but writing, as you know, only arose in the 3rd to 4th millennium BCE. So human language, for roughly 90% of its existence, is a purely oral affair. In those circumstances, translating is a very dicey business indeed, because it's maybe the first fiction of all human history where some community and its neighbour agreed that the voice of the one bilingual slave they had would stand for the voice of each of the principals, and that they would no longer attach the authority of what was said solely to the person that was speaking it, but would, at least for the space of the transaction, agree to the fiction that this was the same as that or had the same authority as that. Without that initial fiction, then we would all still be living in very small tribes and not able to talk to each other. And there's every reason to believe that writing itself arose in societies that were already multilingual, and it arose at least in part, if not entirely, to stabilise translation practice.
So, Janice, your work is always very culturally specific. It's, you know, St. Salt Coats and places like that, your memoirs in particular. Have you been translated into other languages, your memoirs.
Yes, the first one's been translated into Italian and I think the second one's been bought to translate. And I haven't the faintest idea how it would be done, because the first thing the translator will probably require to do in order to make it accessible to more Italians than less Italians is make it standard English and make it a lot more standard than my English might be.
Well, he'll make it standard Italian.
Yeah.
Well, he can't make it dialectal Italian. I mean, you're not Venetian or Napolitan or Sicilian. And if he used, as it were, the regional variants, he'd be misrepresenting you even more.
But I was thinking about a sentence from Janice's new memoir where it goes, "A brass bell in the shape of Mary Queen of Scots, a rabbit's foot and a Scotty dog ashtray made with plaster of Paris and painted black." There are so many Scottish cultural references there. To translate that into Italian, would you include the equivalent Italian cultural references? I don't know.
Well, that all depends. Translations of some kinds of texts are done with a lot of cultural substitution, where you substitute one local reference for a quite different local reference in the receiving culture. Mm. Other kinds of translation don't do that at all. Translating, you know, it isn't just one thing. Mm. It's a whole spectrum of practices and skills that meet all sorts of different purposes that arise. The translation of a literary work is, in a sense, the least specific of all, and in that sense is the easiest, because you can, in a sense, do what you like in a way that you can't in diplomatic and negotiation or in repair manuals and hospital, in court and so forth, where you've got really quite firm boundaries. A literary translation allows you to be free, but also obliges you to be inventive and creative and thoughtful and indeed to have a stroke of luck. I have no idea how your Italian translator will cope with those issues. That is his job. But yes, exactly. Those are the sorts of things where he's going to have to go around the back of it, or else just reproduce them and have lots of footnotes, or else an introduction saying this, that and the other are Scottish things. This is an introduction that sets the context, because one of the things people do learn from translations are the details of other cultures.
Yeah. Now, finally, I do get the sense, though, that you want more translation in the world.
I think so. I think translating is just like it was in ancient Rome or in the Victorian classroom as well, part of a real education, and a real education never stops. We go on. It teaches you about your own language. It strengthens your own linguistic muscles. And it actually, in the end, helps you to know what it is that you've understood.
David Bellos. His book, Is That a Fish in Your Ear?, has just come out. And hearing that makes me think of a report that I did on the translation of poetry. It was a few years ago, and as I recall, it was full of sounds, as many sounds as meanings, at least for me, who didn't understand the foreign words. It was all sounds that I was listening to, and that was kind of the point. Sound and rhythm are just as important often in poetry as the meaning of the words. And in translation, you have to recreate them as well as everything else. And that, by the way, is in The World in Words, number 21. Okay, another couple of books just out are translations. Well, certainly one of them's a translation of Homer's epic, The Iliad. The uncontroversial translation is by Stephen Mitchell. He's a well-established poetry translator. He's got a bunch of good reviews, which means in the world of literary translation that those reviews describe the translation using words like clear-sighted and unobtrusive. These words come up again and again, don't they? The word updated also comes up a lot in translated reviews, especially when we're dealing with the classics. And that word can go either way, of course, either praiseworthy or damning. But updated, Mitchell's translation most certainly is. However, next to another Iliad-themed book that's just come out, Mitchell's translation seems quite traditional. That other book is by Madeline Miller. It's a novel, prose, not poetry. And it takes elements of the Iliad for its plot. In fact, it focuses on Patroclus. He's Achilles' best mate, although he's not that big a figure in the Iliad. And let's just say here that this is translation only in the loosest sense of the word. Madeline Miller says she's trying to appeal to people who maybe are a little bit put off by the classics, but after reading her book, maybe they'll go on to tackle Homer. That's the idea. Recently, she was interviewed by the BBC's John Humphreys and lined up against Peter Jones. He's quite a traditionalist. He's founder of an organization called Friends of the Classics. Here first is Madeline Miller reading an excerpt from her novel.
I stare as my father lifts the garland from my lap and crowns the boy. The leaves seem almost black against the brightness of his hair. His father, Peleus, comes to claim him, smiling and proud. Peleus' kingdom is smaller than ours, but his wife is rumored to be a goddess, and his people love him. My own father watches with envy.
Right, so now that's not quite the way Homer would have written these things. Why did you do it? I mean, apart from the fact that it's a bit of fun to write a novel.
Absolutely. I love Homer and I love these myths. And the Iliad is one of my favorite works, ancient works of all time, modern works as well. And I really wanted to understand who Patroclus was, because he's a very minor character in the Iliad. And I sort of wanted to get his background, his story.
So you did a bit of research on him.
I did.
And produced the novel, which is called? I didn't give you the name.
The Song of Achilles.
The Song of Achilles, right. And Peter Jones, what do you think?
Well, I'm all in favour of creative imitation, which Professor Miller is engaged in. The ancient Greeks and Romans were doing that thousands of years ago. My problem is, would it actually make people want to read Homer? Will not people be disappointed when they pick up their Homer? For example...
Well, because it'll be less racy or something.
Quite. I mean, I haven't read the novel, but I have read what Professor Miller said about it. And she says Patroclus, in her story, is torn between conscience and love. Well, he certainly isn't in the Iliad. She says her story's about a story of love and adventure. Well, the Iliad isn't actually Barbara Cartland.
She says about adventure, though, isn't it?
Yeah, but not love and adventure. Yeah. She says she hopes the novel would combat some of the homophobia that you see too often today. Nothing wrong with that, but it's nothing to do with Homer. When we see Achilles and Patroclus sleeping together, they're sleeping with women. In other words, my problem is, I suspect it oozes contemporary consciousness and preoccupations, which we're surrounded with all day long. Foisting these preoccupations on Homer, in my view, is to remove the interest from him.
Right. Serious charges there, Madeline Miller.
Well, I absolutely agree that I would love people to come and engage with Homer itself. But I think it can be quite intimidating for a lot of people.
No, but that's not the point that Peter's making, really, is it? I mean, what he's saying is that you're using your novel as a vehicle to do something that Homer would never, ever have dreamt of doing. That's part of what he's saying.
Yes, well, I certainly think that that love is at the core, even if we don't say it's romantic love. Love is his love for Patroclus, and his grief at Patroclus' death is what provokes the final act of the Iliad, which is Achilles going crazy with grief and rage. So whether or not you see that as a romantic or a sexual love, it is absolutely at the core of Achilles' character.
And what about your proselytizing?
I think many of the ancients would have said that Achilles and Patroclus were lovers. Aeschylus himself, we have a fragment from an Aeschylus tragedy where he interprets them as lovers. Plato references it. So I'm not bringing this into it. The ancients certainly would have seen them, many of them interpreted them as lovers. And, you know, there's no such thing as a definitive Greek myth, which is very nice.
All right, Peter.
Well, in Homer, they are certainly not lovers, and what you're doing is talk about the Iliad. My fear is that you will paradoxically be putting people off reading Homer when they leave your book, say it was wonderful, they go to Homer, and they find he's not actually a 21st century Californian or an advocate of gay liberation. read the real thing. I'm sure Professor Miller's book is a terrific read in its own right, but please don't use it as a vehicle to read Homer. You read Homer in his own right.
But what if she's filling in gaps? But then, of course, you're saying if she is filling in gaps, she's filling them in inaccurately.
Yes, I mean, I think that I would certainly say that. I mean, if I'm all in favour of people, as it were, paraphrasing, retelling the story as Homer tells it. I'm all in favour of people reading little bits of the Iliad and the Odyssey here and there just to get a taste for them, because these are epics and these are rather forbidding works for the modern world.
Well, there we are, five sentences.
Well, I would never presume to speak for Homer, but I do think that it's unrealistic to say that people have to go to Homer first. I think there are so many ways into this, and not everyone has the means or the time to approach the ancient Greek in its original. So
well,
anything
I'm
that
not
encourages
sure
even saying people...
we should all read it in the original. Naturally, I have. But there we are. That'll be the day, as they say. Madeline Miller, Peter Jones, thank you both.
Thank you very much indeed.
Well, that was fun. And now, more fun. Greece. Greece, you ask? The country with the basket case economy? The country whose prime minister, well, he's still prime minister as I speak, but who knows if he'll be by the time you listen to this. Prime Minister George Papandreou, the selfsame guy who upended European and world markets all week, flipping back and forth on whether to hold a Greek referendum on that euro bailout. Yeah, Greece. Fun. Well, actually, the Greeks are having a bit of a laugh right now. Greek humour, in fact, is going through something of a golden age. You know, what with comedy being such a great way to express those dark moments. Well, there was only one person that we on the big show could have to report this story. So we sent Clark Boyd to Athens, Mr. Black Humor himself. You may have heard some choice Clark moments in previous pods. And as a bonus, listen out in his report for a nice eating sideways expression, armolipi. Here goes.
It's 1 o'clock at the studios of Real FM in Athens, one of Greece's most popular radio shows, Ellenophrenia, or Greek Madness, is about to go on air.
Ναι, είναι Ελληνοφρένεια, όπως κάθε μέρα από το Real FM, 12 Οκτώβρη του 2011.
Ellenophrenia does a bit of call-in and some gag calls to politicians and state offices. Today's target, as usual, is the Greek government, in particular, Prime Minister George Papandreou. Timios Kalamoukas is the show's host.
Πάντα στην Ελλάδα. Από την αρχαιότητα, από τον Αριστοφάνη.
In Greece, we've had a tradition of making fun of people in power since the time of Aristophanes, Kalamoukas says. Humor is the most important thing Greeks have at this time. It's the only thing we have left. He says, you can't listen to Prime Minister George Papandreou and not start laughing. Kalamoukas' favorite joke right now? Well, people have taken to saying, tongue firmly in cheek, George will save the country. Apparently, even members of his own party laugh at that one. But, Kalamoukas says, he also makes fun of himself and his callers. After all, he notes, we're the fools who elected the fools. He says that there's a word in Greek, armolipi, maybe best translated as joyful sadness or bittersweetness.
Θα το καταλάβουνε, αν και οι ίδιοι χρεοκοπήσουνε.
If you go bankrupt yourself, says Kalamoukas, you'll have a better idea of what Greek humor is. Even during the darkest years of our history, the Civil War, the military dictatorship, we approach the situation with humor. I don't know, he laughs. Maybe it's the sun. This song is called It's Never Cold in Greece. Its upbeat sound masks lyrics dripping with sarcasm. Do you want to go on a trip to a magical country where everybody has fun as if they were experts, the song asks? It's Never Cold in Greece is by an Athens-based reggae and ska outfit called Lokomondo. Marcos Koumaris plays guitar and does vocals.
I lived, studied and lived and worked in Germany for 9 years. And the reason I came back to Greece was the humor. This I couldn't live without this thing. And the combination humor and this wonderful weather is for me very important, and I didn't regret it even in the crisis period.
Koumaris' bandmate, Yanis Varnavas, notes that Greek humor is quick, cynical, and direct. Here's his favorite economic crisis joke. It has to do with the kind of job you can get in Greece these days, even with a good education.
Two PhD graduates... one without a job and one with a job meet. And the discussion goes like this. The guy with no job tells to the guy with a job, a burger and fries, please.
If you like your Greek humor with a slightly harder edge, then Lost Bodies may be more your speed. For more than 25 years, the band has been plying its own brand of punk rock. This song, Yelaste, sarcastically invites you to sit back and enjoy while those in power take everything from you.
Γελάστε, γελάστε πολύ, κι αν είναι η μισθή χαμηλή.
Laugh, laugh a lot, the song says. Even though wages are low and life is expensive, forget your worries, laugh, laugh a lot. That quickly gives way to...
Οι στράτιες των άνεργων, οι στράτιες των απελπισμένων.
We can't really translate most of this song on the air. Let's just say that Lost Bodies calls for the armies of the unemployed to break into Parliament and burn it down. Thanos is the band's singer and main songwriter. Our jokes, our music, they're tragicomic, says Thanos. Our jokes are a way of surviving this crisis. Of course, our band's sense of humor is corrosive and poisonous. Well, it is punk rock, after all. I ask Thanos for his favorite joke. It goes like this. The Greek finance minister managed to turn the euro into sh**. He was awarded the Nobel Prize for chemistry. For the world, this is Clark Boyd, Athens.
You can hear Clark's podcast on technology at theworld.org/technology, and I'll slap some vaguely pod-relevant words and images up at theworld.org/language. See you next week.
γελάστε πολύ.